This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community, or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Murray Short, who is past clerk of Friends Yearly Meeting or Conference, and is a leading friend in Wellington, or a leading Quaker in Wellington. And we thought we'd discuss Quakerism today. Murray, can you talk to us about the yearly meeting or Friends Quaker gathering we recently had in Dunedin?
Yeah, sure. So the yearly meeting is the annual meeting for the conduct of the business of the national organisation of Quakers in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The foundation of the church in New Zealand is the worship group, the local worship groups, and there's 28 of those. And they're supported by seven monthly meetings that obviously meet monthly. And then there's the annual meeting, the yearly meeting. And the terminology, yearly monthly meetings, is reflects our desire to avoid any sense of hierarchy in that structure. And that goes back to one of the foundational testimonies, beliefs of Quakerism in equality of all. Yeah.
So what are some of the issues that Friends dealt with at yearly meeting? And can you talk about this and Friends' testimonies generally?
Yeah, so it being predominantly an administrative meeting, a meeting for business, the yearly meeting hears reports from all of the various committees and what we call correspondents that carry out the work of the national organisation during the year. And this work includes organising the national dimension. Bear in mind that most action is taken out in the worship groups and monthly meetings in local communities, but the national dimension is carried out by committees and correspondents. That work includes things like action on our peace and social testimonies, our commitment to peace and social equity, and of course the action needed to maintain a national organisation and presence, such as, you know, the basics of finance public outreach, membership support, which includes both pastoral and spiritual. So we have pastoral and spiritual care committees, and the national body helps support those. Those committees and correspondents also provide updated information and inspiration about the work that they're responsible for. And sometimes they invite outside people to address us. This year we had representatives from the Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies, and the Centre for Disarmament and Security. We also had a speaker on energy issues and energy issues to do with the climate crisis. So those were really very inspirational, and that's one of the roles of yearly meeting, really, is to build the spirit in the membership. We also have the annual Quaker lecture during yearly meeting, and this year it took the form of a conversation between a young Quaker and Dame Anne Salmond, and it was a very personal focus of hers on her experience right from the beginnings as a child, what attracted her to anthropology and then her work in that field. I was interested because she really emphasized the importance of relationship right through that learning and study is much more than just the rational. It's understanding at a much deeper level, and that's built by building relationships with the people that you're studying or working with. Yeah.
How do friends make decisions, both yearly meeting and locally?
Well, we call it a spirit-led process, spirit-led decisions. Of the three main methods of decision making, the authoritarian, the majoritarian, and consensus, we're very, very much in the consensus way of doing things. So decisions require the support of everyone. There's no voting. And the difference with ordinary consensus is that we consider that the process is more than simply a rational process involving separated minds. We believe that there is, when groups get together, there is an element which we call spirit that develops in the group. And from that, we can take a leading that points in the direction that the spirit indicates the group needs to move. So that's the basis of our decision making. Yeah,
I think I've had the experience over the years that the collective group, when we worship together, and there's usually a combination of a long time of silence, but also ministry that's comes from the silence, not something you write beforehand or that you plan on, but it comes to you, that it's like a megaphone for the divine.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. We were influenced by a recent a Quaker lecturer in England called the Swarthmore Lecturer, and the lecturer was this year a woman called Emily Provance. And she made the point that community has always been at the center of Quaker theology. And that's because community enables bringing all the individual perspectives that we all have together to contribute to a group wisdom. And those individual perspectives are driven by our what I call our lenses. Each of us has lenses. Mine are as a cisgender male of Anglo-Saxon ethnic origin, and in that socially and financially privileged group. So those are lenses through which I see the world. And I do not see the world the same as a woman or as Māori, and I certainly can't speak on their behalf, but community enables all of those perspectives to be brought together. The way I express it is that the gift of community is the blending of individual experience of the spirit into a gathered experience of the spirit, and at any time, any moment, we can lean on each other for that completeness. And it's the community that provides that, that much more complete picture.
In my understanding and sometimes experience, that when friends are making a decision and when they're quite close to coming together, sometimes somebody will speak and say, well, I'm not sure if I agree with this, but I think we should go ahead anyway because it seems clear that it's a way to go, and I will let go of my concerns or enable the group to move forward.
Yes, indeed, and that's shared with the consensus method of decision making. But it only works if whether it's a minority or the majority, or just one individual, gives consent to the decision that they sense is the spirit of the meeting. And, you know, sometimes an individual quite late in the piece can bring in a revelation that inspires others, and so they all, being inspired, accept that that person's vision is the way to go. And so they give consent to the process. Now, the other part of consent is committing then to the decision. So unlike majority voting, where you've often left with a disaffected minority who are not committed to the decision, and I might say this is a real problem in local authorities at the moment, where councils are paralysed by minority viewpoints, or even that will not commit to the way forward. So there's a complete lack of leadership. Now, our decisions do require consent by everyone to commit to what is sensed as the leading of the meeting. And in that sense, it's a really effective form of decision making. It doesn't leave a disaffected minority who are uncommitted to the decision. And so the group moves forward and leads as a group.
Haven't friends always had experience of the individual, but also as the collective, the common good?
Indeed. And this brings us back to our origins with our founder, George Fox. He had this revelation that everyone can experience God directly, can have a spiritual experience themselves. And for him, that in the those times, which is the 1600s in England, meant a direct challenge to the church, which had controlled access to the divine, and the only way to access that was through the church priesthood, the sacraments, and the rituals. And Fox said, we can encounter the Spirit at any time, in any place, and we do. Of course, that was a very radical challenge to the church, and because the church and state were closely linked, such blasphemy was regarded as treason, and Fox and the early Quakers were persecuted for a number of years with lots of imprisonment and pretty gross punishments, leading in a few cases to the death of those Quakers. So that was a real foundational belief, and it was a very individualistic belief. If you think of it, what Fox was saying is that every individual can experience God, and for some that meant can experience the truth of the capital. What the early Quakers very quickly found out, though, was that that leads to anarchy. And they had a real problem with people speaking on behalf of Quakers in very, very strange ways and doing very strange things, like going naked for a sign and even more behavior regarded as obscene in the day. So they quite quickly realized that that individualistic revelation of George Fox's needed to be understood and modified with the importance also of the spirit in a gathered meeting. So that's where, as I was saying earlier on, where individuals bring their particular perspectives and that's threshed out in the group. And all those perspectives lead to a powerful decision that the whole group shares. We still struggle with this because that original vision of Fox was so strong and it aligns so much with the growth of individualism in society generally. You know, things like the neoliberal economy are very much based on an individualistic approach where individuals are responsible for their own wealth and health, well-being. And if they are struggling, it's their fault, basically. And so you don't help them or you'll simply encourage dependency and so on. So that's that individualistic view. And the original Quaker view has... fed into that and influenced by it, and so it's still quite strong in the movement, and there's a tension between the individual and the community as a consequence. So we've had to work on our methods and disciplines to really understand how to deal with that, and the resolution has been very much about the importance of community and bringing those individual perspectives to get a broader one, yeah.
Isn't that one of the things that Western society, all societies in modern world are facing, and they handle it differently. And for instance, America is very much toward the individual, and you get people like Musk and Peter Tao, who, you know, that not only have rather strange beliefs, they also think that they can use their individual power and wealth in any way they wish without owing anything to the broader community or to nature. In a way, shouldn't the common good include the environment, the earth we've been given to live on?
Yeah, I certainly agree that the polarization that we see in the world and the United States is not alone in this, can in large measure be seen to have been influenced by the in America's case, the fundamentalist Christian perspective, which you hear Pete Hegseth, the Ministry of War, Minister of or Secretary of War, quoting quite a bit, where he quotes his view of God and how God is supporting his war campaign and so on. So the problem with that perspective is that it's very hard to argue it, to present an alternative perspective. Because if you believe that you know the truth through your experience of God, well, there's no gainsaying that. At one extreme, that leads to the terrorist action, who truly believe that they're carrying out the will of God and will be rewarded in the afterlife. And so when you try and reason with them, It's impossible. And that's what's happening behind a lot of the polarization that we see, is that this very strong individualistic approach. And that's why I say I think Quakers have done a lot of work on the disciplines and processes, procedures that to help bring that more communal-oriented approach, and particularly with the belief that in community we experience the spirit in the same way as individuals do, that there's something beyond the separated irrational minds when we get together to make decisions. Yeah.
You yourself have been somewhat influenced by Martin Buber, a Jewish philosopher and mystic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Buber's book, I and Thou, was a significant turning point for me. I'd long struggled with that individualistic view of the experience of God, and I hadn't really worked out an alternative in my own perspective. So reading Buber was a revelation, because his fundamental perspective is that humans have the ability to maintain two forms of relationship, one the I-it relationship and the other the I-thou relationship. And the I-thou relationship, in the I-thou relationship, we encounter the spirit. And that stands it apart from the I-it relationship. Now, both relationships are essential to human survival. I-it relationships include objective learning and study, scientific inquiry, which requires objectivity rather than relationship, and so on. So they're essential. But writing as he did back in the 30s, he predicted that if the I-it style of relationship dominated even further, and he'd observed that it had increased in perspective, then we would end up destroying ourselves, because for him, the I-thou relationship, which includes relationships between humans, between each other, and between humans and the rest of creation, were essential to our survival. Because, and you can see from a climate perspective, that the idea that we experience the spirit in relationships with nature, which incidentally, by research, increasing amount of research shows we benefit a great deal from our relationships with nature. There's that ancient Japanese practice called Shinrin Roku, which, or forest bathing as it's been translated, and that has been researched quite a bit, and other examples of the health benefits of entering nature. So Buber is giving some insight into why that is. It's because in nature and with each other in community, we experience the spirit. And for me, that has become a foundation perspective through which I now view the spirit, God, whatever we want to call that divine. Yeah.
Interesting things about your experience is you went beyond Christianity to Judaism, or to Buber. And that's something Quakers have, from the very beginning, been more willing to do than some other groups. See that there's that of God, and that not only in available to us and to Christians, but available to other religions and all people. Mm. And I think that's something that's also the many churches, including the Catholic Church and other churches, have come around to this view. In fact, you really have a split between those that believe the only way to be is to be a literal fundamentalist biblical Christian, and those who believe that one way of following Jesus and of being a Christian is to be aware of that of God in other people and in other faiths. That part of being in relationship is listening to each other and learning from each other.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. That whole universalist perspective is very much part of my view of the world. That there's that lovely, I think it's a Buddhist story of the, or proverb about the finger pointing at the moon. Religions and philosophies and other things are the finger that point at the moon. They're not the reality of the moon itself. And so, there is a strong Quaker belief that there are many pathways to that spiritual experience. And that goes back to the Fox revelation about the individual and each individual being a bit different, chooses a different, slightly different pathway to experience the spirit. And our form of worship enables that because it is not guided by the priesthood or even scripture, particularly not ritual or the sacraments. We sit in silent worship and each of us approach the spirit in our own ways. But as we do so, there's this belief that a commonality emerges through that process. Yeah,
I guess that many Quakers would think that the meeting for worship is, in a way, a sacrament.
Well, it is. Absolutely it is. The difference being that for us, it's not the only sacrament, that equally you can encounter the divine sitting in the bush up in the Arongarongas here or whatever, as you can sitting in meeting for worship.
It also strikes me that some of the sacraments and the sacred pointers that other religions use can be useful if they aren't seen as the thing, as God, if they are seen as the finger pointing toward the divine.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. I'm very critical, like Fox was, of the church's role in taking control of our spiritual lives. But on the other hand, the church over the centuries has done amazing things to provide opportunities to encounter the spirit and support worshippers in that process. And I think of the wonderful architecture that it has stimulated, the wonderful music, which are all, for me, sacramental. It's by no means a question of writing all of that off, but simply recognizing that that's part of the picture, but we can also encounter the spirit in other circumstances.
Is New Zealand and the rest of the world in a healthy, confident place just now? Can you talk about this?
Yeah. There's a number of historians who are pointing out, in the face of, I might say, a lot of pessimism and doom on the behalf of many of us, about the state of the world, pointing out that we're actually a much healthier humankind than we have in the past, ever in the past. I mean, if you think of the millions, even billions, that over the last 40, 50 years have been lifted out of poverty and starvation in places, including the Asian and African continents. There's been huge improvements. There's no question about that. Those historians also suggest that the amount of war or conflict, armed conflict, is not as prevalent as it used to be. So some of us might debate that, but they seem to have plenty of evidence to support it. But that brings me to my concerns about the world not being in a healthy and confident place enough. And particularly when you think of climate change, we are now in a situation where the population around the world, the health of the population around the world, is being very detrimentally affected by the climate crisis. And that's progressively getting worse, as we're seeing right now in New Zealand. And, you know, by any measure, that's a lot worse than it ever has been, and we seem so far to be unable to deal with it. In terms of peace, I'm not so convinced that we're a more peaceful place, and very recent events certainly show that. But the other area where of Quaker concern and testimony, which is about equality, we haven't made much progress there, except in terms of the poverty and starvation. One of the things that really worries me is that increasing control of our lives, and you alluded to this, increasing amount of control of our lives over a few super wealthy individuals and the corporate organisations that they represent or own, they have an inordinate influence on our lives now. There's that feeling that democracies are no longer in control of the agenda, and they're increasingly unable to look after the well-being of their populations, which is surely the fundamental purpose of any political system. So from that point of view, I am concerned. And as I've mentioned, the virtually total lack of action on climate is a real troubling thing. And politicians will say that they're responding to the populist perspective, that they're responding to the public. Well, in a democracy, the leadership also needs to take the lead a bit, and sometimes that might be taking risks because it's not popular. But there are examples where politicians have taken the lead. Things like capital punishment, if that went to a referendum, the evidence is from polls over the years that the population might vote for it, but politicians have avoided that from a moral and ethical point of view, and good on them. Well, I wish they were as brave with issues of climate change and so on, and that's a real trouble to me.
Well, I might play us a piece of music, and then we can come back to this.
Very good.
We're talking with Murray Short about Quakerism and Quaker philosophy. Does Maori culture and Quakerism have anything in common in their worldview, in your experience?
Yeah, well, I don't pretend to be an expert on Maori spirituality, but I think there are some real connections there. The concept of Modi in the Maori world, there's a Modi in all things, and that Modi leads to special relationships between things in creation. That's very close to the idea of the spirit being in everyone, and for me, extending that to the spirit, God being in all things and everywhere, that which I describe as a panentheistic view. So, pardon me, there's some pretty close connections there. That, of course, leads to the for example, the decision-making process where every individual's perspective is valued because of their experience of, unique to some extent, experience of the spirit. And when you bring it together, you bring a very powerful mosaic together. So, I mean, in terms of the practice of decision-making, as I understand it in the Maori world, and certainly from my experience on the marae, there's a lot of time spent on kōrero, and so meetings will sometimes take all weekend, and I've been at meetings where people will nod off in the middle of it and then wake up, and one of my mentors, John Rangihau, was amazing. He'd appear to be fast asleep, and then he'd get up and add a point to the conversation that was absolutely on target. So he was obviously aware of what was going on at one level. But the whole idea there is that while the concept of rangatiratanga leader, the strength of leaders was important, leadership depended on thoroughly canvassing the perspectives of the people. And so time and energy was spent on that. And that, to me, is very like the Quaker idea of working together to a point where a decision like a consensus decision is reached. In the Maori world, there's more emphasis on the leader divining that direction, that decision, where it's headed after hearing all of the people around the room. The leader has a stronger role in Quakerism, I think, although there is a role for the clerk, what we call the clerk, who's like the chair or secretary, mix of chair and secretary of the meeting. It is their role to draft a minute, what we call a minute of a decision, and test the meeting with it. So that's a bit like the Maori leader coming to a conclusion and putting it to the people. Yeah. So yeah, there's definitely some similarities there.
Well, I look at the common good or the collective good, and I look at, I think I'm older than you, Murray, and in the time, the second half century after World War II, there seemed to be more of a concern for the common good, and actually more equality in the Western world than there is now, except for Scandinavia, which seems to have hung on to their idea of the common good. But that the thing, when you look at capitalism as practiced now and also as theorized now, when exponential growth and of wealth is the main factor and maybe the only important factor for some people in some expressions of politics and capitalist philosophy, that you look at that, and then it helps you understand why inequality is growing, also why we're not dealing with climate change. You sometimes wonder, looking at some countries and some political parties, if they're not more concerned with the people who have enabled them and often funded them than they are with a common good or even with a the fate of the earth when you consider not dealing with climate change and giving reasons for not dealing with or taking it seriously.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think that the idea of the common good is very much like the well-being of the population, as I've expressed it. And individualism is very much a threat to that, because it focuses very much on the individual rather than the communal. And yeah, the consequences of that, if you look at our economic and social policy settings in modern democracies, America particularly, and New Zealand, it has led to a very unequal distribution of wealth. And at the top, the top 10% own a massive amount of the world's assets and resources. It's just extraordinary. And then at the bottom end, you've got people who are really struggling in good times, and then when challenging times arrive, as they have in New Zealand and increasingly around the world, those people begin to struggle even more. And so things like the housing crisis in New Zealand, where you've got children being brought up in garages and shifting from motel to motel and so on. I mean, if you think of the impact on their education and emotional and social well-being, it's just huge. So you've got that at one end. At the other end, you've got the wealth at the top increasing through things like the financial crisis of the early 2000s, and the same effect from the fuel crisis now. There will be some people who will make money as a consequence of this crisis, whereas at the bottom of the equity measure, there are people now being, more and more people now being tipped into an unsustainable problem and being forced to make decisions that affect the long-term future of their people. Now, that all goes back to the economic and social settings that we've followed for quite some time, and individualism is at the center of that.
If you look at the tax system, it's actually been changed so that it benefits the very few.
That's right.
And, you know, misfortune for the many and fortune for the few is kind of the way it works out.
Indeed. And as I say, the political project is all about, I would have thought, the well-being of the population as a whole. And clearly, the divide between the richest and the poorest in places like New Zealand and the US are not showing commitment to the well-being of the population as a whole, and that's a real concern. Particularly, I mean, it really strikes me that culturally, it's a real surprise to me, because New Zealand, we used to pride ourselves on the welfare state and the equality and so on, and that culturally seems to have gone out of the window. I mean, I don't sense there's a widespread concern amongst the population about families sleeping in garages and emergency housing and so on, and all of the implications of that. I mean, quite apart from anything else, if you look at it from an economic perspective, people are at the centre of productivity. So those systems don't seem to be looking after the people, and therefore not looking after productivity. I mean, productivity depends on having a well-educated, capable workforce. So even on an economic perspective, quite apart from the ethical perspective of having such poverty in our own nation, from an economic perspective, I just can't see how it works, except for those few individuals at the top who have increasing influence over the decision makers.
That's one of the things that when I think of New Zealand and the fact that we sort of in the 80s ditched the welfare state, which is why I think it changed our culture as well as our economics. But also I look at Finland. What do they have that we don't have? They have trees, they have lakes, but they have the best education system in the world, and it's free all the way. I mean, you can go to university. You're expected to go to university if you have the talent, and you don't have to pay for it. In fact, you get supported as long as you work at it. And their whole economy has benefited from that. The people have benefited, so has the economy. But also, if you face a crisis like climate change or war, if you don't have this common good in view, as you had during World War II in England, where working class people actually ate better because of rationing than they had before the war, during the war, it makes it much more difficult to face a crisis. And I think this is one reason for not dealing with climate change is because of our view of the economy and its purpose.
Yeah, indeed. And certainly from a Quaker perspective, the economy, like all instruments that humans use, needs to work for the well-being of the population. And as you say, the crises that we've faced, whether it's the GFC or the COVID era or the current fuel crisis, they have tended to exacerbate the inequalities rather than improve them. And that's all about our economic and social settings. It's interesting that the welfare state used to be called applied Christianity. Now, interestingly, some who have a different perspective of Christianity, like the Peter Higgs of the world, would probably argue that individualism and the competitive economy, dominated by competition rather than notions of the common good, individual competition, is applied Christianity, because they have a fundamentally different view of Christianity. And that goes back to, as I was saying, the way in which the ways we think about God influence everything that we do and say.
You wonder if they take the Sermon on the Mount seriously.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at Jesus' act in overturning the moneylender's table, he was following a long tradition of prophets who were critical of the elite that was emerging. The best example of that was the elite surrounding the temple that were making money out of the church requirement to make sacrifices and so on. So symbolically, in Jesus overturning those tables, he was challenging that whole development of an elite closely associated with church religion. So you can hear the Quaker in me now rather like Fox railing against the role of the church in a lot of this. So just keep in mind that I also see some wonderful things the churches have done over the centuries. But in that regard, interpretations of Scripture and even what was chosen to be included in Scripture by the church at the time have tended to emphasize a view of God that really supports the development of those elites or justifies it.
In a way, there's a division in Christianity right now in the world. You've got, the Secretary of the Minister of War in America spouting a kind of fundamentalist, almost warlike Christianity. Then you've got criticizing both the latest two popes for their concern about humanity and the direction of the world. So there's actually a struggle going on within religion, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And that emerges very clearly from a wonderful sermon given by a guy called James Tallarico, who's a Democratic candidate for the Senate in the US. And in the sermon, he does a profound critique of what he calls Christian nationalism, which is that fundamentalist view, and presents a very different view of Christianity, much more Christ-like, much more the Christ who is the radical social reformer that we see in the overturning of the tables, but also in his care for the down and out in the community and treating them as equals and everything else. I mean, that in those times was a very radical action on his part. You know, sitting down to eat with people that socially was totally unacceptable. Those are very radical social statements by Jesus, and they've tended to be watered down quite a bit. Whereas this Democrat candidate, James Tallarico, I recommend him to you and to your listeners. It's a wonderful sermon, and it just highlights what you're saying about the division in Christianity here.
What does Quakerism have to offer people in these times?
Well, one of the most important things that that we have to offer is that belief that revelation continues, that we continue to learn, and we need therefore always to be refreshing our views of the world, our views of God, and so on. And I must say that despite the Quaker commitment, and that's why we don't have a creed or dogma, because we accept that evolves through conversations in the community over time. That I would have thought would provide a real haven for people searching for a spiritual perspective for our times, young people particularly. Unfortunately, we aren't attracting those people, and that really bothers me. We've got reducing numbers like every other church. My personal view is that we haven't taken that continuing revelation seriously enough, and we still are using old language, old ways of thinking about God, and we haven't moved in terms of our revelation about those matters, as certainly not as Fox did, who was so radical.
Well, I think we're running out of time, but thanks a lot for coming on board. And it's been really good to have this discussion.
Thanks. You very much, Marvin.
It's Murray Short. We're talking about Quakerism. And you can podcast this by going to OARFM radio and then .org and then going to podcasts and going to Community or Chaos. Thanks a lot.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.